I had lived my life sort of just, you know, doing the things I want to do. I want to play some sports. I'll go play some sports. Mm. I think it was sort of after I went to Africa. So my mom was a, you know, becoming a priest.
Yeah.
You know, she does a mission for the Anglican Church Canada down to Zimbabwe. It's 2000. And we go down there, and I guess my entire sort of mindset shifted just because the levels of poverty we saw here, but then, you know, the mansions over here, the level of inequality was just enormous. Mm. And it was sort of at that point where I started to become, let's say, more aware. It probably goes further back where my mom, we're walking into a the mall in New Westminster. My mom and I walking past a news reporter, and she's doing a piece on, you know, what people want for Christmas. And so she stops, hey, little boy, what do you want for Christmas? And I said, oh, I want Lego trauma team. And like, what? Who cares? Like, it's not relevant. But my mom, afterwards, she stops me and says, John, if somebody asks you that question again, the only thing you say is world peace. And I thought it was like, what? But like, I was young enough, there's just, that seed existed. Mm-hmm. And then in high school, going down to Africa, like you start to understand, like, maybe there's more to life than just video games, you know, and playing sports, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And so that sort of sat and percolated till I went to university.
Welcome to the Calgary Sessions. This is episode number 120. It's getting hard to say. I'm your host, Jeff Humphreys. Today's guest is going to be one of those conversations. The name's been in the city for a long time. Me being a sports dude, I get it. So please, name and who you are.
My name is Jonathan Cornish, and I am a lot of different things.
Love it. And the lot of different things is going to be the... that's why I'm pumped to hear this, because the journey is going to be really interesting for me to hear firsthand.
Well, hopefully.
Yeah, and just... And yeah, man, I think it's a cool experience for me to just sit across and hear these stories. So the gist of the show, I like the guests to take it back as far as they want to go. So how they grew up, where they grew up, you know, how their parents inspired them or didn't, you know, just kind of all the building blocks along the way. And then we'll kind of weave our way to where you are today. Okay. So yeah. So take it back as far as you want to go.
Where do you want to start?
So it's like some people go to, like, my memory is horrible. So if somebody asked me the question to go to like kindergarten, I'd be like, yeah, that's probably a stretch. But some people have these bright moments at a young age. So, yeah.
So really simply then, I had a experience when I was a kid that I learned I was really fast, faster than everybody else. I thought it was pretty cool. But then I saw Donovan Bailey, 1996, win the 100-meter 4x1 relay. And then everybody down in the States, the Atlanta 96 Olympics, they're saying, oh, he's not the fastest man in the world. This other guy is, this 200 meter runner. It's like, what the hell is that? So anyways, you know, being the Donovan Bailey fan I am, you're rooting for the guy. And then they have the race between the two of those guys. Donovan Bailey versus Mike Johnson running 150 meters, fastest man in the world in the Rogers Center. Sky Dome at the time. It was like the biggest sporting event that was just like, there's no organization setting this up. It was just two dudes sprinting. Mm-hmm. So, you know, unfortunately, Mike Johnson pulls up lame, got the hammy. Mm-hmm. And then Donovan Bailey wins. And then he goes on to win Canada's top athlete. And I see that and I'm just like, oh, this is cool. Now I'd been aware of Mario Lemieux, Michael Schumacher, Wayne Gretzky, like the guys that won it. Legitimate Canadian athletes. But then to see Donovan Bailey, I was like, oh, he looks like me. It dawned on me that maybe I could use my speed to win the same award, the now known as Northern Star Trophy, but the Lou Marsh Trophy for Canada's most outstanding athlete, male or female. I was like, yeah, it'd be cool to get that someday.
How old were you when that race happened?
I was 12.
Okay, you're a youngster.
Yeah.
Okay.
But just the right age, mm-hmm. like just searching, what am I going to be known for? Mm-hmm. And this was coming off of a grade 8 where I won the individual MVP for each sport that I played in grade 8. I came home with 5 trophies. So that gave it some fuel. Mm-hmm. Summer comes, I see that. I was like, that I want to set this goal. And sort of all the rest of my life unfolded from that.
Did you say it out loud? Did you write it down? Did you tell people, like, when you saw that, when you set the goal, what did that actually look like?
I was always, okay, so let's reframe this then. I had a journal when I was in, you know, whatever grade I was in for 12 years old.
Yep.
And I would write these stories, not stories, but journal entries. So yeah, I tracked today, you know, beat everybody again, you know, it's beautiful, you know, today it got even faster. But, the teacher was reading that, and so she sent home the worst report card I ever had, saying that, oh, he's cocky, he was arrogant. I was like, these aren't things being reflected by friends. This is, you know, a reflection on my journal entry, which I always thought was sort of personal. My mom called me out about it. And so sort of since then, and then great playing football in grade 8, having the coaches tell me, oh yeah, John, don't showboat, don't dance in the end zone, you know, act like you've been there before. What it did for me was teach me not to tell anybody about your goals. And it's, I'm not saying that's a golden rule or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, nobody ever let somebody just say, like, I want to do this. I'd be like, no, more power to you. That's a good friend when they do that. Mm. But most of the time, it's like, sure, John. And like, I've always, sometimes when you have a goal, keeping a secret and being that's your empowering source, not letting other people tarnish it. I think there's value in that.
It's like that internal drive quietly. Some people can't do it, though. Some people need to be very, like, overt about it.
It eventually turns into what I would call them protocols. Some people call them mental models. So basically, I would list out like what I wanted to achieve. Mm. And importantly, the way I wanted to achieve those things. Mm. Like, and so that allowed me to sort of grow into the person I wanted to be while having these written goals. Having those written goals at sort of these different points in time. There was one time where I announced, you know, I'm going to set the Kansas single season rushing record. Second game of the season, we lost. And our coach, you know, he did his thing. He called me out in front of the other 120 football players in the room. It's like, look at this guy. This guy thinks he's better than the team. You know, he's better than all you. Look at him. He's trying to break a record. John, why don't you worry about the team for once? Right? He put me on. It's fine. I still got the record. But I learned, like, you know, sometimes it's just, there's no real reason. Just do it. Mm-hmm. And it's so much cooler that you did it without saying you were going to do it.
Mm-hmm. How did you figure out how to do it? Like, the idea of, like, you doing it humbly or doing it, like, how did you figure out the foundational elements to actually doing it?
Showing up.
Yeah.
I think, like, a lot of people don't realize, like, even the act of getting out of bed should be celebrated. Not everybody can do it consistently. And then sort of each step you take throughout the day. I thought that I had a lot of support. People were like, oh, John, you got to go to class. John, you got to do this. Through the years, I mean, I was always a pretty good student, but I started to realize, like, there's, for the things that you put energy into, there's an output. And if you don't put energy into anything, then you won't see any outputs. Mm. A lot of people don't realize, like, oh, my, why is my life bad? Like, everybody has their own set of circumstances. But I think life is really about how you respond to those circumstances. So for me personally, it was pretty cool to rephrase it. So I heard this quote, it's a video game quote, but if you're encountering bad guys, you're probably going the right way, right? So, you know, if challenges, obstacles, these are things to be risen up to, you know, to elevate yourself against, an opportunity to do that. Not everybody sees it that way.
Do you think it's, did you figure that out? Did you're like, was there somebody around you that would kind of help shape that idea? It's a different approach to it. Some people take, like, it's not an obvious approach.
I think being a running back in football requires a certain mindset because I said in another interview, just in my professional career, I was, I had 50 touchdowns, but I had 1,050 touches, which means 1,000 times I was knocked out of bounds, smashed, you know, tackled, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you respond to that? And so early on in a football player's life, you learned that, you know, the real thing that glues football together is the quote, the only play that matters is the next one. I've lost in my life. Mm-hmm. But it's from those wins, those losses that I actually have won the most, like have learned the most.
Yep. So walk it back, grade 12, grade 8, you're 12 years old. Starting to play ball. Like, what is the youngster? What is the young version of you? Actually, you know, what else is he into besides just winning everything he touches?
Playing video games.
Yeah,
it's been a very solid, consistent part of my life.
Where'd you grow up?
Vancouver.
Okay,
in New Westminster in Vancouver. Okay. So I had one really close friend, and then like you know, like all kids, you have your other friends and stuff. But me and this close friend, we were both half black. We lived kiddie corner from each other. So we ended up spending most of our days together. So we played video games, Lego, all that kind of stuff, sports, Lego, basketball and stuff. Yeah. But like it was the video games that really made me feel like this is what I want to do with my life. And not there was no YouTube careers or anything like
Twitch.
That. Nothing like that, unfortunately. But I knew like, you know, I think if I could just, you know, make enough at work and be able to play video games, I'd be happy.
You were all in. Would you did you ever consider like besides being like a pro gamer, you know, designing games or like, were you like all in on this kind of world?
In my early college career, I produced mods for games. And so the game of choice was one of my favorite games at the time, Free Space 2 and Free Space 1, or it's Descent Free Space and then Free Space 2. And I made a mod that basically imported like other stuff into the Free Space into another game, Homeworld. So Homeworld was a like a 3D art real-time strategy game. So I brought the ships that you only could control one of in Free Space into Homeworld where you could control all of them. So it got really popular. And then you know football story kicked on. I started getting involved with other stuff. So I still do organizational stuff. You know, led a world number one guild for a little bit. That was interesting in World of Warcraft. But like there was organizational efforts and stuff. But my real job or whatever my vocation was never video games.
Do you ever have the chance to speak to like youngsters about pursuing video games as a life? What I find fascinating is you know, pre YouTube, pre Twitch. Pre like all the games, like when they're selling out arenas now with like live gaming, you know, back in the day, there's no way that ever would have been in the realm of possibilities. Now it's actually like, you can have that conversation with a youngster and be like, if you're really good, this can be a thing.
It can be.
Sorry to interrupt. Do you think it's still like, you know, to be a pro athlete, 0.00, what, you know, it's like the best of the best of the best. That's still that in video games, right?
It's one of those things where your hobby becomes your full-time job, your career, and not everybody gets to enjoy that. Like people that get to play sports their whole lives, you know, let's say hockey players play until 36, 37, then you retire and then like you don't have to do anything else. Not everybody gets to enjoy that. And when we talk about like YouTubers and stuff, the amount of YouTubers, like for every person with a million followers you see, there's a million people with 1,000 followers, right? Like the scale, it gets really weird because the big people get super big and everybody else just collecting scraps.
Yeah. And that conversation rarely gets talked about. You know, it's like that. That's a good way to put it. You know, there's a million at 1,000 and nobody really, but they're always looking at these unicorns, like these pros that.
It's just something about it, just like you, Jeff. You know, there's that special little something, the magic sauce. Yeah. Like, and that's what a lot of people don't understand. You can't be successful copying somebody else. Whatever you do has to be your thing. I mean, everybody's sort of derivative in one way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
I know my football career, I liked what this guy did, what that guy did, what that guy did, and I put it all together, right? And I think a lot of people don't, like, if you want to start a YouTube show, don't just play the exactly same game the exactly same way somebody else does.
Yeah, yeah. What does high school look for you? What are you into in high school?
Yeah, so high school was interesting. Like I mentioned, lots of different sports. But I found that there was value in like one of the things about sports. So grade 8, you know, it was middling. You know, grade 9, we won our first provincial championship. Grade 10, people are starting to realize, okay, this guy can play a little bit. So then by grade 11, a lot of people throughout the Lower Mainland knew who I was. So I was already like getting TV time, and it was interesting. I started to realize like, oh, I can go almost anywhere and one person will know who I am. And there's a lot of power in that by itself. So I started interacting with people from across the Lower Mainland. Still played a lot of sports. But I would say, I mean, I played video games. Like, it's funny, when I look back, the things I recollect the most, yes, good party here or there. We had my crew, the Black Knights, you know, with the best friend I was telling you about and a bunch of other guys. Like, and we'd go Richmond, Vancouver, North Van, South Surrey. We'd go everywhere. And my high school experience was top-notch. Great friends, great sort of departure. It was nice to have everybody around, going off to Kansas and stuff. Good times. But, you know, like at every point in my life, there's been one or two little things that, like, it's funny. It doesn't matter how much good somebody has in their life. Bad, for a lot of people, just matters that much more.
When you're kind of coming through high school, are you focused on anything in particular? Is the drive to go to Kansas, or like, was that a thing, or was it, you know, are you just all in this video game idea? Like, what were you chasing? Or were things just coming at you and you're reacting to them?
I think it's a good question, because I had lived my life sort of just, you know, doing the things I want to do. I want to play some sports. I'll go play some sports. I think it was sort of after I went to Africa. So my mom was becoming a priest. She does a mission for the Anglican Church Canada down to Zimbabwe. It's 2000. And we go down there, and I guess my entire sort of mindset shifted, just because the levels of poverty we saw here, but then, you know, the mansions over here, the level of inequality was just enormous. And it was sort of at that point where I started to become, let's say, more aware. And it probably goes further back, where my mom, we're walking into the mall in New Westminster, my mom and I walking past a news reporter, and she's doing a piece on, you know, what people want for Christmas. And so she stops, hey, little boy, what do you want for Christmas? And I said, oh, I want Lego trauma team. And like, what? Who cares? Like, it's not relevant. But my mom, afterwards, she stops me and says, John, if somebody asks you that question again, the only thing you say is world peace. And I thought it was like, what? But like, I was young enough, they're just, that seed existed. And then in high school, going down to Africa, like, you start to understand, like, you know, maybe there's more to life than just video games, you know, and playing sports, you know? And so that sort of sat and percolated till I went to university.
Did she do that on purpose? Do you have siblings?
Yeah. And I was the only sibling she did that to. She had 5 kids, so I'm the 4th.
Okay. So you think she made a conscious decision to kind of expose you to that at a specific age or an age?
I think she became more conscious of it herself. You know, initially, when I was coming up, she was a piano teacher, music director for churches. Like, she's entrepreneurial. Only parent, so she was struggling with that. But I think once she started getting more into the church, the volunteering aspects of it, like the service elements, where she needed to be a servant leader, I think that was, for her, what opened up her mind to it. And eventually it just bled into the family.
Yep. What grade was that?
Grade 10.
Okay. So kind of going through the rest of high school, what is your vision? How does it start changing, and how do you end up at, you know,
That point, we're going down to Africa. I was like, I want to be a doctor. I want to go Doctors Without Borders and stuff.
Like, you want to start changing, like,
But no change. I just didn't think I would get a college football scholarship, right? So you just, like, at any point, you should always have a backup plan or a backup to the backup plan. A lot of people think, no, I'm doing this. They're like, okay, well, you can have other options as well. And so it's sort of coming out of that grade 11, it's starting to be like, okay, I might be able to get this football scholarship. Come grade 12, my grades are there. You know, the grade 11, we won provincial championship. Grade 10, we won provincial championship. So I basically won three provincial championships in a row, JV and then two grade varsity ones. And so at that point, it was like, okay, they ended up making a trophy. I say trophy for me, but they didn't want to give the MVP to the offensive and defensive MVP to the same person. So they made a new trophy, the player of the year. I was the inaugural recipient of that. And sort of at that point, it was like, okay, I'm going to go to college for something. What is it going to be? UBC was pretty heavily recruiting me. Yep. I went to their University Connect program, which is cool. Like you get a week on campus as a high school student to check it out. It was awesome. And it showed me what I wanted to do. I wanted to help people psychologically. So then when I eventually did go to college, I studied psychology.
Why'd you go down that path? Like, why the psychology piece? What was your, like, connect there?
I had spent a lot of time in my head, right? Like, not so much problems or anything like that. I've always been a thinker. And I've became very clear to me that other people's thought processes were different than mine. Because of that, I was like, you know, maybe I could understand this better. And then sort of, you know, there's another thread. There's the, you know, so there's a service thread, there's a sports thread, and then this sort of that last piece, the long-term career thread. Mm. And I'll just touch on that right quick, because that's my mom again, you know, walking through the same mall, actually, walking past a TD Bank branch, and there looked like really diverse people. Like New Westminster was not a diverse town at the time. Mm. And I saw, like, there's a lot of people that might look like me. I saw a guy shaking hands with another person, suited up. Mm. And they both looked really happy. And I was like, you know, that's what I want to do eventually. I want to help people with money. So, like, I mentioned doctor. That's what my mom wanted. Mm-hmm. I mentioned sports. Said, you know, just a trophy. I didn't want a sports career. I just wanted that trophy. Mm. And then the real sort of aspiration was to, like, you know, use the psychology to help people better save and understand money. Wow. Right. And this all came together over the years in high school and a little bit into college. But it was funny to see those three different pieces, how they sort of wove their thread.
Because to be walking through that mall and to make that observation at that age.
My mom had five kids. Money was tight. We would not have power sometimes. I was always fed, though. I was asked recently if I was ever hungry, and I was like, no, there was a few times, but it was mostly at my friends' houses whose parents had said, John can't eat anything more.
You're fasting until you got to their house. He's coming. Were you, being in your head, were you quiet about it? Like, was there enough going on in your head that you were just like, you could sit in quiet and be with yourself versus like being an extrovert and just, you know, be loud and obnoxious?
Yeah. And sort of in my age now, I'm starting to sort of come to terms with it. Like, I've never really had this desire to, like, you know, collect all these friends and be the most popular guy. Mm. I've always had a desire to make people laugh. Mm. Right. And I think that's sort of when I look at my, like, humor style, it's mostly contextual. Right? I'm not just going to tell a joke, but I can, you know, say some flippant remark about the current situation and it could be funny. Mm. And so, like, I guess more so I've just gotten comfortable in who I am today.
Yeah.
But sort of back in the day, I think there was I wouldn't be described as a quiet kid. Mm. I was always, you know, like I said, lots of friends and, you know, social and stuff. But, like, when school was done, I would, like, we would sometimes have our after school club. But if I didn't have football practice, basketball practice, I would just go home. And, like, I wouldn't call anybody. Like, I just like my video game time. It's the same today.
Some things don't change. The consistency. When you get the scholarship, is that a moment in your family? Is that a moment to celebrate?
I didn't realize. It was, like, by the time that actually happened, it was, like, February, March. And I had scholarship. Like, it wasn't once this the season was done and I could actually be contacted.
Yeah.
It was just like, okay, which school am I going to go to? Mm. So we were let down. I had a full ride scholarship to Stanford, right? Which was, like I said, I had good grades, but I never cared about French. And it was funny. My mom always said I was going to go to Stanford and that I needed to get my French grade up.
That was like,
why do I got to learn French? I don't need to learn it. And so didn't work. But University of Kansas, I had aunt and uncle lived close to the campus, mm. another aunt and uncle that lived further up, and another cousin that lived in another spot, like lots of family there. Mm. And so that's why I eventually chose Kansas as the spot to be.
Mm. And is that, you have an older sibling?
Yeah.
Were you the first one to go to college? Or like, how does the college system fit within your, like...
So my older two siblings, my older sisters, they went to Capilano College and UVic.
Okay.
And then my older brother didn't go to school. And my younger brother didn't go to post-secondary either. Mm. So it wasn't...
Yeah.
It wasn't necessarily a thing. Yep. I think a lot of people, like, would have preferred to stay in Vancouver. Mm. Whereas for me, like, I thought there was an opportunity to just leave. Like, it wasn't like I wanted to leave, but, like, here's an opportunity to do something else.
Yeah. The CIS versus NCAA, was it always NCAA on your kind of roadmap?
You know, I think the thing that really did was like the looking at the actual value of the scholarship itself.
Right.
And I was just like, it'd be, you know, I could go to Kansas, you know, a perennial powerhouse, basketball, mm-hmm. you know, brand new head coach coming in. I had family there already, you know, and like, you know, sort of having that opportunity to play college ball in the States, like going to the Big 12, you know, play against the teams I'd watched growing up, Oklahoma, Nebraska, Texas, right? Like those were the places I wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, when Kansas offered a scholarship, it was actually the first school to ever reach out to me was Nebraska. Because they had a guy, you know, I think yeah, technically, rest in peace, Darren Diedrich. He was a running back for them. Canadian running back at Nebraska? It's like, I can go play some Big 12 ball, too. And it's funny. Everybody has a trailblazer before them.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people think that, especially today, that they're the only ones, that we have the first person, no, there's somebody that's done it before.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's super important to recognize those people that did this so you could do this so somebody else can do that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, yeah, they don't even know they're that trailblazer.
They're just figuring it out themselves. See that all the, and it's common with people around our age today when they go into large boardrooms and stuff like that, where you might be the only person of color, only transgendered person, whatever it is, right? Like everybody's having to break that glass ceiling for themselves, but you're also breaking it for those other people, and you're only in the room because somebody else did something to get you. Like,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. has that come around full circle to you yet? Has anybody like reached out to you and said, "Dude, I watched you. I watched you at Kansas and you know, you kind of, I could see myself doing that." And has that come around yet?
So if you look at a guy like Chuba Hubbard, right? So he played high school football here in Alberta, and then he goes down to Oklahoma State and he rushes for 2,000 yards, right? First person to do that at Oklahoma State since Barry Sanders, right? Like it's just incredible. So a great job that he did. But he watched me growing up. Right, so it's the generation now that's like coming out of college and stuff. So there's the Cornish Trophy that goes to the best NCAA Canadian football player.
No way. When did that get?
I think we're in our sixth year now.
Oh, cool!
Yeah, this is
amazing.
Football Canada runs it. It's housed at the Canadian Football Hall of Fame.
Amazing.
But they, because of my trials down there. Right, where, you know, you lead the team to its first bowl game in a decade, end a 56-year losing streak against Nebraska, and now I still hold four records at the university. But it was all unheralded. Nobody cared about Canadian players in the NCAA. There's like three guys. Like, who cares about them? Mm. But now there's over 100, right? Mm. And these guys deserve recognition, and that's why this trophy was created.
Amazing. Only three guys back? Like, there was a small number of people.
Yeah, there was a small number of guys.
Hmm.
Right, we had, out of BC, in my like, when I went down, we had four guys go down south, and only two guys actually stayed.
Hmm. So. Just chalk, just didn't work, just...
There was some growing pains. I think a lot of people didn't really understand that there's a huge difference between the States and Canada.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks it's the same. It's not remotely the same, guys. Like, we speak the same language.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're actually in Kansas, you have a Kansan accent if you're from Canada, or really Western Canada.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody could tell down there that I wasn't from Kansas.
What was, did you have any of those experiences down there that were like, oh, this is, we're like,
yeah,
this is different.
So I eventually got a car. Every time I left the parking lot, I got pulled over. And I say this with a bad in an eye, every single time. So I added 15 minutes to wherever I was going because I was going to get pulled over. Campus police, mostly. And just, hey, you rolled through that stop sign, didn't put your turn signal on, you rolled up too fast, on that, like whatever it was. A million different excuses. Mm-hmm. Twice, I was asked for signatures.
No way.
But, yeah, I think it was 15 times I was pulled over. And every time you have somebody rolling up to your the side of your door with their hand on their gun. Like, it wasn't quite as prevalent, that knowledge that cops killed black people. But now we could see it. But to put it in perspective, staying out of my aunt's house, Lawrence Independence, Independence, Kansas. So where the Chiefs play and Arrowhead Stadium.
Yeah.
And there was one thing I wasn't allowed to do there. And it was so weird. I was a college student. I wasn't allowed to go out for a walk at night. It's like, no, I'm going to go out for a walk. I want to go for a walk. Like, my aunt was almost crying. Like, because I came home like 30 minutes later. Because I didn't want to go on that walk anymore. Because three people came outside with their shotguns while I was out for this walk just wearing my normal KU gear. Right? It was nighttime. Mm. But going for a walk in the States is weird by itself. Mm. Going for a walk as a person of color? Like, it just wasn't done. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't done. I went for a total of two walks the entire time I was at Kansas. That one, and the other one was just in my college town. I walked from my dorm down to the grocery store. Nope, never happened again. People would slow down to stare. What? Like, it was incredible.
How do you deal with that? Like, how do you?
I mean, like, at the time, you don't really, like, what's everybody doing? Like, it doesn't really compute. Mm. It takes potentially even years to understand, like, why did that happen?
Mm. And obviously, no, I'm not going to speak for you. When you're back home in BC, like, those experiences...
No, I'm not going to lie here.
Different?
Well, because BC ended up being really weird. Mm. I had no issues with racism pretty much at all. It was like a little bit of little kid stuff, stupid stuff.
Yeah.
But no real racism. But then once I started coming back through sort of college, post-college, that's when the cops started like, unfortunately, my friend group was, you know, the ultimate smattering of diversity, right? So we had our indigenous friend, we had a Mexican friend, we had our Middle Eastern friend, and we had another black guy and two half black guys, right? And so if we went someplace, or mostly when we left someplace, the cops would just follow us around. They tried to give us jaywalking stuff, like all these different, it was always interesting to see what they try to come up with, because I never had that sort of the time where they like did anything.
Yeah, yeah.
They just followed us. Sometimes they tried ideas. But yeah, so I don't want to blanket cops. I have plenty of friends that are cops.
Yeah.
It just, you know, I had those experiences. Mm-hmm. My friends did, and I've never been arrested. Like, you know, I've received a total of like two parking speeding tickets in my life. Like but that still happened. And there was no negative outcome. But like, I had to walk back to my friend's house with a cop car with their lights on the entire time. And they just followed us for no reason. They had nothing better to do than that. So yeah, part of the story, but not a large part.
Mm. What's happening in college? Are you, is it fit? Does it fit with kind of who you are and what you want to achieve? And like, is it a good thing that you're in Kansas?
I made it a fit eventually.
Yeah.
First year, I played as a true freshman.
Rare.
I got like a sort of hurt or something in like the second before the game even happened. Like, I was running down the field on the day before the game. Like, just wore, like, something happened, my hip was busted, and it was enough that we had lost the second game as well, so I was like, okay, John, you can just get your medical red shirt. Cool. Come back into camp the following year, and, like, it's definitely because I was up till 3 a.m. playing video games, but I tore my rectus femoris, so one or quadricep muscles. Mm. I wasn't diagnosed right. Like, the person would say, oh, your leg's still plenty strong. I was like, no, I something exploded in my leg. So anyways, I have to pull myself out of practice. That's not something that's cool. Coach walks over to me. You know, I'm on the sidelines, on the knee. Coach whispers in my ear, Cornish, you're a pussy. I laughed. But it was enough that I understood my place on the team. To really lay that bare. Eventually, you know, this isn't actually 2 years down the line, coach is like, he's cussing somebody else out in the team meeting room. And I just laughing to myself because I always found, like I said, internal dialogue that is funny as hell to me. Is it, Cornish, where are you on the depth chart? It's like, eighth, coach. That's right. And you're going to stay there. So that sort of defines basically the first half of my college experience on the sports side.
Yep.
But because that all transpired, I was like, well, I'm just going to get involved in the other stuff. And that's when I got involved in campus politics at the Jayhawk Towers as you know, treasurer and then vice president of the organization, got involved in fraternity, Pi Kappa Alpha. And sort of doing that stuff led to me getting recognized by the sort of campus student governance people that be. Yeah. I was like, John, come join KU United. We're going to run. I was like, what's the platform? I was like, we're going to get on-campus Wi-Fi. And they were like, we didn't have Wi-Fi at the time. The campus powers that be, they didn't think it was relevant for students to have Wi-Fi. So I campaigned on getting students campus Wi-Fi. And of course, there was a ulterior motive, being able to play video games in class.
It all comes back.
Yeah, it all comes back to video games. So anyways, we succeeded in that. And then it was actually the first time I'd been recognized by my coach positively when he asked me to stand up. And I didn't know what he was like I said, all these negative experiences. And Cornish, stand up. John was just elected by his peers as a student senator. And that actually marked sort of the turnaround of my time. I had a great time in college, hands down, beautiful time. But that sort of marked the turnaround on the football field.
It's like the duality of it, you know, like you're getting shit on over here and then you're kind of, did you just have to come up with your own way to hack the system? Like just, okay, if this isn't going, I gotta like.
And people, you use the term hack the system, but I don't think people realize like compartmentalization is the most powerful thing you'll ever do, right? Like, you know, people talk about like, oh, the war in Ukraine, you know, how can you be happy when things are so bad in Palestine? Horrible. Compartmentalize. Mm. And I think there's a power that comes with that because you're able to still live.
Yep.
And I think, I mean, everybody does it. Like, let's be honest here. Like, you know, how's the climate out there? Like, everybody compartmentalizes. Not everybody uses it as a superpower. Mm. And I think it's important that we all sort of cultivate that ability so that when you actually encounter these things that are challenging and tough at work, you can still go home and be nice to everybody there.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and that's... It's super interesting this when you really start digging into it. It's almost, I believe that there's a choice component. Do I want to dwell on this longer? And I talk about the psychology and being my own, like being able to control your thought process, which is really impossible, but having some say in the process, super important. And so that can be cultivated by million different ways, but not everybody actually tries to cultivate that power at all.
You think it's... you think they don't because it's difficult, or do you think they don't understand the process?
Well, you said hack the system, and I think everybody has been part of the system. So how do you think that you could do anything different? And I think that's a real key. Like, you just need to see somebody do something differently to understand that that could be done that way. Mm-hmm. Think about all this disruption in tech, right? Like, Facebook? Like, where's the Facebook? And I got MySpace. Why do I need Facebook? Mm-hmm. Oh, it's a little bit classier. It's like, these simple things. Oh, Facebook, why do I need Instagram? Because I already got my pictures on Facebook. But then, now we have AI. Like, people don't realize how much sort of disruption is just part of every day. And if you aren't trying to switch it up because you've done the same old thing for years and years and years, it's like, it's what I do. There's the curmudgeonly, like stubborn. Listen, I don't know anybody that's won because they were stubborn.
Yeah. What did the other way I've kind of heard it being phrased is like, if you're not going forward, you're going backwards.
Yeah.
And it's kind of that like.
And yeah, football coaches will say, if you're not in, you're out. If you're not getting better, you're getting worse. And those are all true. The way I like to think of it, this is definitely a video game reference. Canadian duo, one of them was a filmmaker. The name of it was Pure Onage. Great, great little, like, before YouTube web video. Eventually they made it to Showtime for a season. But in that, the best gamer, the owner, the owner, yeah, it's owner a bunch of times.
Yeah.
He says, if you're trying to be the best, you must be the best at all things. And it's not so much, and I don't take that to say you have to be the best at everything, but just legitimately try to be the best at the things that you legitimately try.
Mm. It's an interesting way to look at it. What happens on the second half of that college career?
Oh yeah, so you know, get my Wi-Fi going. You know,
did they carry you around? Like, did they actually?
No, they didn't carry me around. But like, you know, then you're in the student senate meetings, playing video games in the back. I was like, okay, well, I think my time on student senate's done. But then, like I said, I had that vice president in my housing, and then they're like, John, oh yeah, get this island. And I was like, what? So let me put it in perspective. We go back to Kansas a few months back, you know, so I get to raise the flag before the football game. Hmm. We go there, great. Wi-Fi has been like iterated, and it's obviously brand new Wi-Fi and stuff. And so like none of that part of the student senate career sort of existed. But there was one thing, the last thing I did was get a island over a 3-lane road. And so you can't build a crosswalk over a 3-lane road. You got to have an island. Hmm. So we got the island built, and the island's still there. Right. And so that might, you know, one of the chief signers on that legislation. So I was really happy about that sort of legacy piece being there. But I was brought back down to Kansas because what I did on the football field, that, like I said, 8th on the depth chart. Turns out, you know, one guy had bad grades. Another guy had, you know, some stuff with the girlfriend. Mm-hmm. One guy tried to go into an A&W drive through the reverse, like through the window to grab more food and stuff. It didn't work out that well for him. Anyways, all of a sudden I was number 2 on the depth chart. And so I ended up winning the team MVP as the number 2 running back on the team. And I thought that was pretty cool. And so I ended up winning the team MVP twice. The following year I set the all-time record to Kansas, most yards of the season, all this stuff. And it's like, it's good. You know, the college experience was good. You know, I went to the NFL combine. Mm. But like, it was actually during that, because I was drafted by the Calgary Stampeders a year before the NFL stuff. And then I was just like, you know, I think I questioned, and I don't normally question myself, but like, I didn't know if I was good enough to be a 4 or 5 year starter at running back position in the NFL. Mm. I knew I had the skill set to do it, but I didn't know if I had the drive to like, and it's sort of in retrospect, like I was way better than I thought I was. But at the time, that's where I was. Like, could I win Canada's top athlete as a backup in the NFL? And I thought that was decidedly no. What are my chances of being a starter in the NFL? Well, that's dependent if I get drafted. If I get drafted, I'll stay in the NFL. If I don't, then not. So I ended up finishing number 5 in the NCAA in rushing. I thought it was a shoe-in. I had 2 other guys, and maybe you might know Marshawn Lynch and Adrian Peterson come out in the draft with me. But then there was another 5 guys drafted you've never heard of and never played a down. I was not one of those guys. Had I been, I would never have been in Calgary. Mm-hmm. But I think it all sort of worked out
perfectly.
Yeah.
Did you have this balance between the kind of school community, like outside of sport and in sport? Did you have a balance of like how you managed your energy between both kind of worlds, or were you just like all in on one?
I think I always had that sort of ethos, right? Like, you know, just in the things that you're gonna do, just try to be good at those things and don't focus on other things. So I tried to sort of limit, I guess, the things that I tried to accomplish, and it allowed me a lot more time and freedom to do the things I wanted to do. So like between, you know, that video game element, yes, I did play World of Warcraft at the NFL Combine. There's the other pieces where it just, we have a level of sort of balance, because you find balance is valuable. Like that's what I always found. Like, I don't want to play video games all day. I want to play video games every day, but I don't want to play them all day. Like, you know, a few hours here, you know, I'm good.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I got the wife as well. Okay, that's a balanced piece. And then, you know, making sure that, you know, you got your family or whatever. And then those other pieces, like I got my wife, I got my family, and then I got my sort of community.
Yep.
And I think it's, a lot of people don't spend enough time giving back to their community. Mm. But I know, like, from my time with St. Peter's, it was really seeded going back. You know, my mom had me sort of volunteering in Africa and stuff. But, like, I didn't volunteer by choice in high school. But then it was once I volunteered at Habitat for Humanity. And you build a house for somebody. Mm. Then they walk into a house. They've never owned a house, right? And this is theirs now. Like, it still makes the hairs on the back of my neck stand up.
Yeah.
And so that seeded sort of this volunteering psychosis, whatever it is. Yeah.
That's a good way to put it. How do you, when you're talking about balance, how do you fit yourself into there? And both, like, physically and mentally, how do you fit yourself into those?
I find a lot of people don't have space, right? So I go from work to home, I have to cook meal for my kids, and then I have to take them to sports practices.
Yeah.
My mom didn't really get to enjoy that too much. She would take care of, you know, the kids that were at home, and then she'd, you know, do a little bit of music directing stuff, and then she'd go and teach kids all night, and then she'd be done at like 8:30, right? And that didn't feel like it was great for her. She becomes a priest, and then she works all day, right? She ends up stopping being a priest because she gets cancer 5 separate times. So I was very acutely aware of the effect of stress, right? And like, so I you know, some kids, they emulate that trait of their parents.
Yep.
Some people have the exact. My mom is now super relaxed. I mean, you know, you go through cancer 5 times, it changes you. For me personally, like, having that chill mindset, just being easy, man. Like, a lot of people get worked up about stupid stuff.
Yep.
Yeah, I get worked up about some stuff, but it's like important issues that we should be doing something about.
Yeah. Yeah. You can moderate yourself to know, like, when you need to, like, be worked up.
But so that sort of chillness, you know, on the football field, I always made sure I had my Dr. Scholl's in my cleats, so I was gelling all the time, you know, in the classroom or later, you know. So football was cool because, you know, CFL was set up, you could finish practice at 1:30. I'd be back at my home and by 2, because I always lived close. You got, you know, think about your time, how much time you waste traveling back and forth. So I lived across the street from the stadium.
Amazing.
I get there and then I lead my raid guild for 3 hours, and then I'm done by 5, and then I have the rest of the day. Like, just build the life you want. A lot of people don't, so they can't have chill.
Yeah.
And then it's not as fun.
Yeah. Your journey to Calgary. What that actually looked like.
Yeah, so drafted in 2005.
Sorry, when you're coming out of college, were you, did you want to chase a pro career? Like, was that?
I was following football as it took me. And like, my ultimate career goal would be investment advisory, but that needed to come when it came. Like, I had a football, you know, people are like paying for me to live here or go do this stuff. Like, cool. Drafted in 2005, get up to Calgary. Turns out that the coaching staff that was there never even watched my tape. It's like, you know, I guess I was one of the best Canadian athletes of all time in college. No?
You missed that?
No. So I rode the bench. But in 2008, we won our Grey Cup.
Yeah.
Like, started, you know, catching some, oh, he's all right. Mm-hmm. I averaged 8.5 yards a carry that year on 200 something yards. So, like, pretty decent. Mm-hmm. And then sort of by 2010, I was splitting reps with the main guy. And by 2011, I'd taken over. Mm. So
long process.
It was way longer than I expected. I thought, like, I could even come up to the CFL for a few years and go back down. No, that's the problem. When you have a guy like Joffrey Reynolds in front of you, you know, he had 8 consecutive 1,000-yard season. Yeah, you can't. There's certain things you have to understand that you're going to have to wait for.
Yeah. Was that that process, did it irk you? Were you okay with that, like seeing it out over all these years?
I think the way it worked out, it was perfect. Mm-hmm. I got to sort of have my, like, you know, backup Canadian running back that might be super good. I think St. Pierre's kept me very happy contract-wise. Mm-hmm. And it allowed me to have this life where I could come and go from Vancouver to here and just, like, chilling. Like, it was crazy how open that life was when you only work 4.5 hours a day. Like I said, you know, I had all these other things I could do. Mm-hmm. But then it was once I became the starter, I realized, like, hey, I don't have any more free time. I have to start working on next life.
Right. And that switch, you just realized it needed, you needed to, like, fully commit to this?
So I became a starter on the football team. At the end of that season, I walked in with my resume to the local TD branch, or a few TD branches, and there was actually a little bidding war between those guys to the Market Mall branch. And that's, so I was basically a starter at the same time I started working at the bank. And it's actually been confirmed to me recently. I was the only guy for the Stampeders in the last decade to work and play at the same time. Most guys would work during the offseason, but I did both.
Obviously, very strategically, because you knew what the out was. That workload, though, to do both, did it ever catch you in a moment of time? Be like, man, this is, I bit off a lot here.
So my time at the bank was interesting because it was basically volunteer time. I made an election to 100% deposit all the money into my RSP. Mm. Cool, but like it was basically volunteer. So I would wake up, you're go to practice. And I'd go, like, I think the real key is, like, if you know where you want to go, it's a lot easier to go there. Yeah. You can't go to a place that you don't, like, where is this place? Oh, I can't tell you where it is. I know it sort of. No, when you can define where you want to go, all of a sudden, oh, John, you know what you said you wanted to be a football investment advisor? No, I got a guy I want you to meet. And so this guy, this is just off of a football practice. I come in, the head trainer training another guy who's, like, not on the football team. This other guy, Lynn Tanner, he led Tech Canada, the CEO mentorship training, networking. I'll introduce you to Jim Davis. Who's that? He's CEO of First Energy. So he brings me to the investment bank, walks through all, like, a bunch of different staff, get to pick their brains for 2 hours. Like, and then all of a sudden I had to pass from football to where I am today. Mm-hmm. And when I saw that, that's a piece that I had been missing, the mentorship piece. I was always on my own before, making decisions sort of on my own. Like, everybody should have a mentorship network. They should have the people they're receiving mentorship from and the people that they're passing it to. Mm-hmm. I learned that day. And sort of from that sprouted a bunch of other mentors who have, you know, one I was actually talking to as I walked into this room. Mm-hmm.
It's some people look at mentorship. Well, I've been giving it a little bit of thought lately. Sometimes it's hard to, it's not an ego thing that gets in the way, is it? Of like, yeah, I don't need help. Like, what is it, just because we don't know what that help actually looks like? Like, what do you think that stumble is to, like?
So you see it at all levels. Like, you hear it, so you can't fill a cup that's already full.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's that simple. I think there are people who are predisposed, they don't need any help, and that they're going to seek help.
Yeah.
There's other people that will learn that if you seek help, it's there. And then there's other people that don't need any help, right? And I think in all of those classes, categories, there's people that will succeed. So there's no common denominator. I think it's just a lot easier when you help others.
It's kind of that basic. Do you, when you said you knew what you wanted, like in the banking world, how do you, a lot of people don't have that direct sight line to what they want to do. And they spend a lot of years like in this gray zone.
I was a little kid. And so the definition to me was I want to help people with money and I want to dress well. Right. And so a mentor helped me hone that in on the job title investment advisor.
It's very, those two, like have money, make money, and dress well.
Like having gone to the church,
yeah,
seeing people in their Sunday best all the time,
yeah,
you know, I just felt like there was a like almost like a fit.
Literally. When you're done playing ball, is it on your own terms? Like, how would you describe the out?
Some people might say it's not on my terms. Some people would say it is. All I know is that I got a job offer from TD Wealth.
Yeah.
And that was it.
That was it. And why were you ready? Like, what was it?
Because I had a job to get where I am today 4 years ago. Yeah. So I became an investment advisor. Like, I was run my own book.
Yep.
So I mean, 6 years between being a football guy and doing something else. Is it that long? No. It's 3 years because I was playing football 3 years in between, and now I've been running this practice 5 years. Mm. Right? So, like, because I did that sacrifice to play,
yeah,
they created this opportunity to get actual hands-on experience. A lot of investment advisors just, they can sell, so they get a job. Mm. I have a CFA charter. I've managed hundreds of millions of dollars on some of the most prestigious wealth teams in Canada, right? I had experience. Yeah. I understood the value of having that experience. And so with all that, I was sort of in a place where I could be ready to do this job that I wanted to do. Mm. Like I said, you know, psychology all the way back in the day, you know, how people think, you know, how could I apply this to? And so all that sort of made it an easy call for me.
Was it like 2 years earlier? Would you have done it? If that job comes across the table 2 years earlier, would you have gone?
No.
What I'm getting at is, do you reach a point in your professional career that you've accomplished a bunch of things and you kind of put it to bed?
I don't think everybody does. But I think I was in a unique circumstance where you win the Lou Marsh Trophy, Northern Star, whatever they're calling
it. Yep.
You win the Canada's Top Athlete. And then as the reigning Canada's Top Athlete, you win the Grey Cup. Like, I don't know, guys. Like, maybe we should just call it. I think we're done here, right? Right? So that a lot of people don't really put context,
yeah,
right? Somebody's life, like, oh, why did John? Oh, must be concussions. He had a concussion. He got knocked out. I got knocked out. But that's not the reason why I retired from football. Mm. I got retired from football because there was nothing left to do.
Mm-hmm. Which is, I don't want to say comforting, but it gives you, like, gives you peace knowing that what you did was, you've, like, checked a lot of boxes, and now you can move on to what you've always wanted.
There was a niggling piece. So you got to win the Grey Cup MVP.
Yeah.
And stuff. And, you know, that might have been nice. But, like, you start to realize, like, there's a million things that you haven't done that you never will do. You can't feel bad for not doing so. Mm-hmm.
When you're in your sport career, somebody said this to me. I can't remember who it said. But they learn most of their lessons from all the losses. It might have been Lumsden, actually. He said he never won anything. And he's been on this pursuit of winning. How do you take that into your world now? Like, is it seamless? Are the lessons very clear to you of, like, why?
It is seamless. And a lot of, like, and that's where football players get it wrong. Athletes, like, oh, I've played this sport. I can't do any work. This is all I know. It's like, no, the football players know one thing for sure. The ability to shoot the shit. Right? You stand around watching people run around and you might go in for a few seconds every once in a while. You have the ability to talk, which means you can do 90% of the jobs right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a level of a lack of confidence that I bridged because I was in the workplace. Mm-hmm. I started working before I left. Mm-hmm. There was no transition point. Mm-hmm. I just got a promotion, right? It wasn't a football, like, people let these other things, like I said, you know, thinking like somebody else does,
yep,
rather than what can I do? Well, I have, you know, most of the day, I from 2 p.m. on, I led a world number one raiding guild in the afternoon. Like, let's put some words on. World afternoon North American raiding guild, number one. Right? Because we're the only guild that raided at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But I realize, oh, I'm doing this. Okay, I can apply this to other places. I think nobody understands the skill set that you have is universally applicable.
Mm.
Like, you've done things that could make you do well at any job.
Yeah. Do people know that? Does, like, the PA kind of go down this path and help educate players?
It's been the toughest piece of my post-football career. And it's not just football players. It's not just selections of high school students and stuff. There will always be people that do not care. And but how I say it for sport players is that I'm a little kid. I imagine myself being a football player someday. Great. You become a football player. Nice. I made it. It doesn't click that you're never... it's not a forever thing. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to be a football player. I want to be an investment advisor. So it was easy for me to think about these other aspects, but nearly impossible for other people to think that they're anything other than what they're doing right now.
Mm-hmm. Is that a constant conversation that you're trying to push, or is it just like...
Yeah, and I think I'm coming up with ways.
Oh, cool.
I used to think it was money-based. Yep. It's not. I used to think it was confidence-based. It's not. It's community-based. You're on a football team. You're on a sports team your whole life. You're coming up. That's all you know. Mm. So how do you broaden that network? Yeah. You incorporate the Calgary Stampeders Alumni Association. Yeah. You see all these different leagues across the country, globe, are starting to bring back their alumni, mm-hmm. getting these people that have gone on and gone through all this stuff so they can mentor mm-hmm. these people that are still here. You're mm-hmm. starting to see it. Mm-hmm. People are starting to get it that like your knowledge is not just for you.
Mm-hmm. It's the perfect segue that you're talking about community, this volunteer piece that you kind of lit up about. How does that fit in? Has it always been a driver for you since you've been in Calgary?
I don't know, man. For me, the ultimate thing was volunteering for the Children's Hospital because I got to do two things, play video games and help, right? So I push around the video game cart every Tuesday night, just knock on the kids' doors, hey, you guys want to play some video games? And sometimes you see the parents and they'd be like destroyed, like so sad and stuff. But then you see the kids are like, mom, come on, how much more time are you going to cry about this? I'm sick. I just want to be a kid. And this was that opportunity. Mm. And so some of the things that came out of that, you know, outstanding relationship with the Alberta Children's Hospital, but then the Alberta Children's Hospital Foundation. Mm. And it was the foundation where I told them, I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to do all your public speaking engagements. And they're like, no. And then by 2019, I was doing all this, except for the Candy Cane Gala. I wasn't quite big enough to MC that, although I got to fight with a Jedi sword against a bunch of little kids. Amazing. So, okay, cool, cool. it showed me that as much as you think the stuff you do with your time is important and stuff, like it's not. Like my wife and I sort of, I don't say we're over-volunteering at this point, but like I think we've taken it to its logical endpoint where you, talk about my wife. Yes. She's calling right now. we are sort of in a place where, we started our own organization, the Calgary Black Chambers, right? Because she wanted to just, stop going from 10 organizations, 50 organizations. Yeah, it was her idea. Well, a lot of people, it has been erased. And that's one of the things about volunteer organizations is that like, new leadership, new ideas, cool, but like sort of the groundwork and all that kind of stuff can be at the end of the day, nobody's being paid to be here.
Yeah. And you're a busy man, dude. Thanks for doing this.
Well, we barely covered it,
dude. I could jam with you for a long time, but I am fascinated how you've kind of. Just how your brain ticks, because it seems very I don't even know how to explain it. Logical?
Yeah, I watched a lot of Star Trek growing up.
Like it's like yeah, and as I'm listening to it, I feel like I feel like it's very heady. I feel like you've been in a thoughtful place for a long time, which is
unfortunately.
Yeah, which
my wife tires of it, but. she's told me before that there's just a certain value in sort of just thinking on your own.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't like come up with original ideas. And that's why maybe if that was something somebody took, some listener out there from this conversation, like just because that's the way it's done doesn't mean it's the way it has to be. So
I'm not going to let you go yet. Do you think that's, where does that come from? Do you think it's like, if there's a group of kids and one kid thinks like that, Is it based on their, like how they grew up, like their family kind of circle, their parents, or is it based on something, some other external spot?
If, from all my thoughts on this, I think, I mean, I tried to ascertain, right? Like, why am I the way I am? I think Montessori was sort of the space, and I say that because I was given space. Like, Montessori is about, like, let the kid learn within a framework, right, versus telling the kid what to learn. Mm. And it always made me different because then I got to normal school in grade one or kindergarten.
Yep.
And then all the kids just were doing what they were told. Mm. And that's been my biggest problem. People don't ask that I like, don't like that I ask why, right? But in understanding that why,
yeah,
it's empowered my entire life, mm, right? Like every single thing that I am today is because I asked questions. Right, I wasn't just content to be do what I'm told at any point.
And sometimes that can come across as whatever word you want to use.
I know, it's like going back to college. John, they're like walking in, brand new coach. Brand new coach. John, you're uncoachable. And it's like I've never met you before, right? This, like that's, and you have to be willing to deal with that. Mm-hmm. And I, like people say, oh yeah, you're John Cornish. You know, you get by with it because you're you. It's like, this is what I made for myself, right? Mm-hmm. Like there wasn't always this, but when you believe and you do the things that you believe in,
yeah,
it creates, like I said, you know, people don't put enough input in, so there's no output. Right, so what are you trying to put input into your life? Mm-hmm. And then I am that output of those things that I did 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And that piece right there, right? It's not an overnight thing. You know, before we get on air, we're talking about something that doesn't happen,
yeah,
just by chance, right?
Compound interest is you know, I think Einstein's, I'm paraphrasing here, but if more people knew about the power of compound interest, you know, everybody would be rich. Mm-hmm.
and that transfers into everything, right? Like it could be like this. This body of work, the compound, like it's the same kind of idea, right? I think it's that seems to get lost on people. Like, do the work.
Yeah. And so like when you're doing a few different things simultaneously, you're working on your football career,
yeah,
you're working on your next career and you're volunteering, all of a sudden you're the youngest chancellor in Canadian history. You know, they're managing a pretty decent practice at the largest asset manager in Canada, one of the largest in the world. Mm-hmm. And there's a football trophy named after you, and you got into the Hall of Fame on the first ballot. Like, so it works out, guys. There's proof.
How do you, if there's like one giant takeaway, how would you coach somebody to put them in a spot that they could kind of leverage, something like that could happen?
Patience. The most powerful virtue you can have is understanding sometimes, and it's not all the time, but sometimes there's nothing you can do about it right now. Sometimes actual change takes super long time, right? Like, you know, to go from Donovan Bailey to me, like there's many, many different people, lots of different sports,
yeah,
right? But, you know, that belief,
yeah,
always stayed and it got stronger because I was inputting into it and then you see the output and that's not always going to be the case. Sometimes you have to be cool to switching gears. Mm. But I got to be cool with picking up the lieutenant governor that I've made wait for 15 minutes now.
I end the show with one question. When I say Calgary, where's your head go?
The best. Best in the West.
Amazing. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.